So I began thinking about doing some sort of documentary work about bulletin board systems around the year 2000. I then started buying equipment and making plans and began shooting in January of 2001. The movie was released on DVD in 2005 and was sold through the website and through Amazon until, let's say, about 2009. After that, it was sold on Amazon used as part of their market. And in 2017, somebody decided to give it a review. It was not a positive review, 2 stars out of 5. But I feel like, even though I don't think it was fair, years later, I feel a need to think about the ramifications of what it said. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. Let's just get the review out of the way and into the record. Here it is, from Mike. 2 stars out of 5. So when I heard about this, I was super excited. The documentary is heartfelt. I grew up in the 1980s, hardcore BBS nerd on my Commodore 64. So when I heard about this, I was super excited. The documentary is heartfelt, but the execution is abysmal. There was literally no effort put into anything. The cinematography is atrocious. The Q&A isn't that interesting, but could have been made light years better with a little bit of thoughtful editing. If you grew up in the 1980s using BBSs, you'll want to watch this, but it could have been so much better. Let's take this in pieces. First of all, the reviews, the responses, the letters, the communication I've had both online and off about the BBS documentary tells me that the intended effect, one of capturing a history of a rather ethereal world, many of its ramifications and many of the different aspects of what was truly a revolutionary time and technology, the vast majority are incredibly positive. I've had people on the edge of tears telling me things that this documentary made them remember. Just by thinking about the amount of people who are gone, who are no longer with us, who are in this documentary, tells me that it was fundamentally worthwhile to do. Not a single bad review or a single negative take on it is going to make me rethink that. It's not about whether or not I have 100% buy-in, whether I walk around with 5 stars and golden accolades from every quarter. That's not why I made this. That is certainly not where I'm judging this. But instead, I was kind of fascinated by what led to this review. It's in 2017. That means they either bought the product used, or they were using an online or copied version. As you would expect, the documentary is open licensed. Anybody can watch it anywhere. You can download the original DVDs from archive.org and watch it yourself, exactly how I intended it. For the record, I intended it to be watched on something like VLC, which can take an ISO and give you all of the features, like menus and commentary tracks and subtitles. You name it. It's there. Anybody can watch it with my blessing. It's not about making some extra money on this documentary. Although I will say, the documentary did make its production costs many times over before 2010. Now, I'm more fascinated by what's going on here. Why did this person, Mike, find the documentary so wanting? Yes, I could obsess about this word or that or take umbrage, but really where I'm coming from with this is remembering what led to the BBS documentary in the first place. When I started TextFiles.com in 1998, It was created just to be a place that would stop an ethereal amount of history from being gone forever. Putting up tens of thousands of text files and having them downloaded for whatever purposes people wanted, that's why I did it. It was about making old history easy enough to find. To that end, it has been a roaring success. It was only later, when I thought about making a bulletin board system list that would span every bulletin board in North America, that I realized that there was something even more ethereal than the text files, and that was the human stories behind them, behind bulletin boards, behind bulletin board lists and groups and mail transfer, that if we didn't do something, whatever we were going to be, it was going to be lost forever and become what I would call a sort of cramped, inaccurate, but easy to recount version of what happened. To that end, I was lucky. I had a film degree. I had some ideas on how to tell a story, and I'd had an experience of creating various works, editing them, and putting them together. So it's 2000. There's no YouTube it's going to end up on. There's no real market that I'm going to be able to become part of beyond maybe a rental store or rental stores or selling them via my website. Perhaps textfiles.com could tell people where they could pick this up. So I started out with no idea what was going to come out the other end. My thinking was this: get as many stories as possible. Record people talking about their history. Record people answering questions that I came up with and providing them with an opportunity to talk about areas and places and events that otherwise never would have been recounted in any form. Unless you get everybody around a certain event, you're always going to have missing parts, dropped threads, things that people might not have known in the majority. Maybe only one or two people knew the actual truth. But if you record enough people to get an idea, you at least set up a framework, something for others to build on, to say, well, it makes it sound like everybody believed A, but what about B and C, and what did that have to do with that time? Because the documentary functions not just as a recounting of something that happened. It represents a display that can be stood in front of and recanted, refuted, and ignored. But it has to exist first to be those things, to provide all of those other services. So I decided very quickly I was going to have to do a lot of traveling. I was going to have to go into people's homes, and I was going to have to do a lot of individual setups. I could have gotten a crew, but I felt very much that it would have been really expensive to bring in a variety of people that would travel with me to do the crew work. Make no mistake, it's better, it's easier, it's all around much more comprehensive to have some level of staff with you. But I felt that a crew of one would give the flexibility and the time to go places that would otherwise fall by the wayside simply because I couldn't assemble the crew that week. So a single person it was, and in doing so, I then had to decide how I was going to transport an entire movie studio with me. I came up with a two-bag solution. A large bag for the lighting rig and the tripod and a couple other pieces of power equipment, and then a small bag for the camera, the recorder, the cables to drive them, and to store the main parts of the lights. Part of the reasoning behind that was that if I was going to travel inside of a plane and I would check in my luggage, and remember, this is right after 9/11, there was a chance my luggage was going to be delayed. And if it was delayed, I'd want everything I needed to be in my carry-on. That camera got a lot of TSA attention during the first half of the first year of the documentary. its lenses were unscrewed. I was asked all sorts of questions about my intentions and inferences about who I was. I often say that I looked a little bit too much like I might cause trouble. But that said, I ended up traveling to places I never would have if I hadn't done it this way. I would go to Texas, to Oklahoma, to Chicago, to Illinois, to Wisconsin, to Oregon and California, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. There were times I would travel through 9 states across 2 weeks to get as many interviews as I could scoop up. In many cases, I was doing 2, 3, and even 4 interviews in a single day. So let's walk through that. I would show up at a house. I would talk to the person about what the project was, which, again, there was no precedent to point to. I would look around the house, figure out where the best setup was, hope that the sound was good, set up lights, set up the microphone and the recorder, sit the person comfortably, and talk to them for maybe 1 hour, 2 hours, maybe even 3 or 4, about something they'd never been interviewed in depth before and probably would never be interviewed with again. And I would cover it based on how I felt about the person's comfort. For some people, they'd agreed to be in the documentary, but they didn't understand the ramifications of talking about their lives. They needed to be reassured that what came out the other end would make them not look like freaks or weirdos or perverts. They wanted to know respect was what was happening. This was part of why, as the documentary progressed, I would put up photographs of the production to point it to people who were skeptical. Quite a few people were skeptical. I would say, look at all these folks I have, and everything we did and everything we covered. And that would inspire a few to agree at the very last critical moment. The dig in that review about bad cinematography just strikes me as odd. I would have anywhere between 10 and 15 minutes to set up somebody's house in a way that I could record them. Some people had homes that were absolutely beautiful for this. Others just had a desk, often near a humming machine they wouldn't turn off, or inside of a house that had family in it. And I would set things up as best as I could and interview them. When you see a documentary where everybody interviewed looks absolutely perfect, they might only be doing 1 interview a day with a crew of 5 and people focused on the look and the sound, and then the interviewer, the producer, the camera person, and then they do the interview. That wasn't the case here. These were done one after another, some of them at parties, at conventions, where I would try to find a room, maybe a hotel room, in one case a gym inside of a hotel. In some cases, at the office, where they'd close the door and tell me I had 1 hour. Maybe I'd get a beautiful workshop, other times I would just get a living room. And the interviews themselves were conducted in a wide range of subjects. I didn't know what a Jason Scott documentary series would look like. I didn't even know it would be a series at the end. So all of my questions are incredibly speculative. Sometimes I'm learning things as we go. A person would mention a subject in one interview, and then I would randomly ask a few more people about it as I went down the rest. Ultimately, it took 3 years to interview 205 people. The resulting footage was about 250 hours. From that, I culled it down to maybe 40 hours of useful answers, and then from there, made the movie that people see. What's important to note here is once the movie was made, once that pioneering approach was done, I didn't want to see another movie like that either. I wanted it to look beautiful. I wanted a sense of graphics and sound that would make this one look absolutely terrible. And that's why GitLamp is shot in high definition, and also with a slight more attention to how the interview shots were laid out. It also only has about 70 interviews shot across 2 years. I was able to focus on the subject at hand because it was so well documented before. People had done interactive fiction as a history, as a playable nostalgia, and as a source of books and academic papers. And from those, I could draw a script, a general outlook as to what this story would be. BBS documentary didn't have that. It was done out of love and duty. And it's interesting to me that this person would write a review when there have been a dearth of later documentaries about that particular time, as if it was wrong. It's not wrong. It's just how it was done. But I hope people listening understand that the real lesson here is what I'm talking about for people who are starting out on a project. At the other end of it, there are going to be people who wish you had done it better. There will be people who will find something they don't like and let it irritate them to the point of dropping its rating down to almost nothing. And will let it irritate them until it's driven the score down to nothing. But they're not who you're making this for. If you know why you are working on a project, if you know that this history is in great danger of disappearing, or this tale of this person will be lost if you don't take the effort, that is why you're doing it. Ending up on a piece of plastic, or a streaming service, or a torrent is nice. It's been nice to hear from many, many, many thousands of people who have watched all of these works. But when I was driving late at night back to a hotel that I knew nothing about before I stayed there, thinking about how the day's interviews went, I was thinking about what subjects I needed to focus on. I thought about people I had yet to meet, but at no point did I ever think I'm on the wrong track. If you've got a goal and it matters to you, you're on the right track. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Dileep Reddy, Sean Kelly, Trixie the Cat, Martin, Sembiance, Benjamin Guts, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere, who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. The BBSDocumentary.com site is still up. It can be browsed for history and file collections and, of course, the finalized work. I stand behind it. People who come in and assume that anybody wanted to make a bulletin board system movie in 2000 are going to be disappointed. This is a movie that stands alone, and believe me, absolutely believe me, I really wish it didn't.